So today I'm going to change topic. So move on with the main line, main arch of the course. So if you have some questions before I start, that would be a good moment. Wait a couple of minutes to see if more people are coming and So the topic today will be how the covariant phase space compares to the canonical phase space. So what I argued for in previous lectures was the space of von Schell fields, so they satisfy the equations of motion with the symplectic current integrating over any Cauchy surface. Oh, I will always work now with no boundaries of the Cauchy surface. So these objects together form are a good proxy for the phase space of the theory. So the question is it actually symplectic, and how to do this properly? So this was more of a heuristic based on the case of the scalar field, where everything works nicely. But if we are doing a gauge theory, is this really the case, and how do we go about it? So remember, an important point was that on shell. This was sigma independent. So one needed to integrate it, but to get rid of the fact that this omega underline is a form over spacetime. We don't want a form over spacetime, we just want a form over field space. So we need to integrate it over a sigma. But if we work on shell, which sigma we choose doesn't really matter. Okay, so the picture, again, I draw my beans here. So we have two surfaces, Cauchy surfaces without boundaries, and spacetime in between. Sigma initial, sigma final. We have some normal n coming out of. So this is how we build this covariant phase space. So maybe I should call it covariant here. And the question is, is F omega sigma symplectic? And how does it compare to the canonical phase space? So we need to revise a little bit how we do, how we usually compute the canonical phase space. So let me end. This is question one. Question two, how does it compare to? So the question is, even we never really defined this canonical phase space, so we need to revise how it is usually done, and especially how we can construct it in the framework we're working in. So, quick reminder. So the recipe to construct the canonical phase space is the following. You start from the action. You take its variation. You do delta S, well, or delta L is the same. You find the equations of motion plus something. Well, let me do delta S. Maybe it's a bit nicer. We integrate the equation of motion over M, and then we find a boundary piece, which is dl over d phi dot and delta phi, something of this form. Now, what we do is to just call this pi, and then we say that pi and phi are canonical conjugate variables, and the phase space is just so. Pi, phi, canonically conjugate. This is a heuristic recipe, of course. It's not, I'm not trying to be very precise. And by which we mean that their bracket is one for a delta function, if you prefer, delta xy, which is the same as saying that we have some symplectic structure over sigma, which is the boundary, this boundary here, one of the two, which is delta pi, delta phi. Right? So this is the usual recipe. So how does it talk into what we have seen so far? Any questions about these heuristics like this? So remember, this is like doing the Legendre transform in the Hamiltonian formalism. This is exactly what comes out when you go from velocities to momenta, and those are the canonical momenta that enter the phase space structure. Okay, so how does this speak into the formalism we have developed? Of course, these are the equations of motion. This is our theta. So canonical phase space from covariant picture. So an important remark here, we never went on shell. Right? When we do this, we don't care about solving the equations of motion. We just look at the boundary term. Whereas here, we were going on shell. It was very important to go on shell. So we want to formalize this procedure here now. And we do it as follows. We start from F, the off shell field space. Then we have omega, which is the symplectic current,
And
this is basically what theta is,
right?
This is theta integrated over sigma. And this is roughly theta, well, this omega integrated over sigma, except that we are treating pi as an independent variable. So this is the step I want to explain. Why are we allowed to do that and what is hiding behind? So from here, then we say, okay, let's take some sigma, and we define omega sigma as the integral of the symplectic current. And the point is, we mark this pair is not symplectic. Why? Well, we can check that d omega sigma is closed because it's exact. So there's no, because d exact, so there is no problem here. But the second point is that we want it to be non-degenerate. That's very important to be able to define a Poisson bracket, for example, because we need to invert the structure. So, but highly degenerate. How do we see that it is highly degenerate? Well, it's easier to go by examples. So let's start from the scalar field and then try to do electromagnetism as a more sophisticated example where even more is happening. So, example. So we want in the end to fix this problem to define the canonical phase space. So let me just note it here. Idea. We quotient out the kernel. To define the canonical phase space. So somehow we have to take the kernel of this and get rid of it. So we want to quotient it out, and whatever is left over will be our canonical phase space. That's the idea. How do we do it in practice? It's best seen by example. Okay, so here, the scalar field, minus 1/2 d phi square, epsilon. So it's the usual story. So I can, maybe I'll go a little bit faster. So omega here. So let's do omega sigma. Oh, I can't write omega. So this is d of, how do I write it? Let's do it by step so we don't get too confused. So this is, there's no integral. This is just delta phi dA phi epsilon A. Do you recognize this? Does it make sense? Okay, so now we take another delta. It will go across and hit this guy over here. And then we will have to integrate over sigma. So omega sigma is the integral over sigma of integrating over sigma. So when we pull back this to sigma, we get the conormal times the volume form of sigma. So this is the equation I'm using. So this will become the normal derivative of phi. Wedge. D phi epsilon sigma. So this is nothing else. This is what one could call phi dot at sigma, right? Is the derivative of n in the normal direction. Now, why is this degenerate? This looks like the usual thing. The point is that the space on which this form is defined is a form, is a zero, well, is a two form on F. This is the space of fields over M, not sigma. So anytime we make a little a perturbation of our fields far from the surface, we change our fields somewhere here, this will not be registered in omega sigma. Right? So whatever we do up here will be completely transparent at sigma. This was different to the story that we were telling on shell. Because if we work on shell, we are not free to change our field just here, hoping that nothing happens in its past and its future. If we change it somewhere, this change will propagate through the equations of motion, forward in time and backward in time, so that every change will always be registered on sigma. But here we're working off shell. So whatever we do up here will not be registered. So so a bit more formally, we could say that x of this form, delta phi over m, so here it's important that is over m, with delta x phi of compact support, let's say, disjoint from sigma will be in the kernel of omega sigma, is such that Ix omega sigma is zero. So there is a humongous kernel here. So what we want to do there's nothing really physical. It's more of a formal way to do things. We want to identify all configurations that, how can I say these? Let me first be more specific and find the actual kernel of this object. So this is an example. But so more generally, X belongs to the kernel of omega sigma, is what we were calling omega sigma flat, if you remember, when we just contracted in one slot and we look at what comes out in the other. If and only if, well, we do the computation, 0 omega sigma is equal to the integral of what? We get dn of delta x phi times d phi minus the other one, so we get dn delta phi multiplying delta x phi. So we want this to be zero. Now, so this is the same as delta phi dot, but these two are independent quantities at the surface, as we observe many times, independent functions on sigma. So what does it mean independent? It means that I can change phi over sigma without changing its normal derivative, and vice versa. There, I can find configurations where d stays, phi stays the same, and phi dot changes, or vice versa. And I can do this completely freely. So this is zero, if and only if the coefficients of each one is zero by itself. So what does this mean? This means that any variation which keeps phi and phi dot fixed at the surface will be in the kernel of this symplectic structure. For example, could be something that keeps phi and phi dot fixed but changes phi double dot. This will not be seen by that by omega sigma. So that is x is in the kernel if and only if it leaves phi and phi dot unchanged at sigma. Remark, it could change, for example, it could still change phi double dot, the second derivative in the normal direction. We don't have any condition. So what we want to do to get rid of the degeneracy is to identify configurations which are related by such a this kind of transformation. So this is a bit abstract. It shouldn't be taken too seriously physically. It's just a mathematical trick to start from something too big and reduce it to something smaller where there is no kernel for omega. So I'm just saying, formally speaking, I want to identify all those fields which have the same phi and phi dot at the surface, even though everything else could be different. And this set of equivalence classes will just be labeled by phi and phi dot. It's a bit of a trick. It's nothing to be taken too seriously. So I'll write it here. So we want to get rid of the kernel. Therefore, we identify, not physically, just mathematically, all configurations that have the same phi at sigma, which we can call straight phi, and phi dot at sigma, which we call pi. This space, so formally, what I'm doing, these are equivalence classes of my field. And I say that these belong to P, my canonical phase space. If you want, I can call it P canonical, equal to F modulo the kernel of omega sigma. That's how we constructed it. So we justified this idea of renaming that object pi, the delta lambda over d lambda, sorry, not d lambda, dl over d phi dot. We justified why we can give it a new name and why, how this, in which sense this phase space can be constructed from the covariant picture. Okay, so the last step is to define the canonical structure, the symplectic structure over here. So the picture is the following. We have F, we have, in F there are some direction which are those in the kernel of omega, which I will draw like this. So this is the x, where x is in the kernel of omega sigma. So this direction will be not seen by omega over here. And down here, this is p. To each orbit of this vector field, I associate a point. So this is f modulo the kernel. Does this picture make sense? Yeah? No? Yeah?
So you don't lose, you're saying this is just a mathematical trick and
yeah.
You don't lose any physical.
Well, I'm throwing out a lot of information, but the fact of, so here I'm even off shell, so there is basically no physics that we're, right? We are not even looking at the equations of motion of these things. So there's not much physics to lose, in fact. It's a kinematical construction, and I'm just trying to find a mathematical procedure that I can apply to different theories to build such a off-shell canonical phase space in a way that is compatible with the usual algorithm that we do in mechanics. So this is how, from this symplectic picture, we do it. It's just a rephrasing of the usual thing. In the usual story, you see, you are also here, you are just keeping the boundary values of these quantities and throwing out, you are ignoring the equations of motion. The idea is that you will implement them later via Hamiltonian evolution. Right? So in that way, it's not really too different. It's just that we need to be able to do these in terms of this, by using this symplectic, this would-be symplectic form that are sitting around. So I'm just trying to generalize the procedure in a way that uses the tools we have.
Okay.
So the fact of identifying them is a trick, in a sense. It's not that they're physically identical, they're very different. But they're also all kind of unphysical in any case, because they're off-shell history. So it's just a way to say, oh, I want to pick these. And the fact of, as I will explain in a second, the fact of taking the quotient is the trick that allows you to build a non-degenerate structure on P. Because now, if we identify the direction of degeneracy, we can, quote unquote, because it's not precise, project omega from here to there, and we are ensured that it will be non-degenerate. By construction, it's just in that way. So now the point is, how do we project omega down? We can't project forms, because forms pull back but not push forward. So, and here, the operations that goes from up there, okay, now I'm running out of letters, so I will call it little p. Is a projection. So let me call P is the operation that goes from F to P and maps phi to the equivalence class. Oops, sorry. Phi to the equivalence class. So this is a projection. We can't push forward our forms from here to there. What we can do is to pull it back. So the idea, we define omega as a two form on P by demanding that its pullback. So we bring it from down here to up there. Its pullback to be omega sigma. So the pullback of this kind of pullback will produce something degenerate up here. Degenerate in which direction? Exactly the directions that I'm quotienting out. But these are the kernel of omega, so that's why it works. So the kernel on the left-hand side is manifestly the kernel of omega, so whatever is left over will not be, this one will be non-degenerate by construction at that point. Okay, so this weird idea of doing all of this procedure that from F omega sigma with the kernel produces P omega non-degenerate as a quotient by the kernel, essentially, by the kernel distribution, is called presymplectic reduction. Because you start from something that is not symplectic, it's called presymplectic, and you can produce something symplectic by just quotienting out what you don't want to be there. So it's that's what it is. Good. So the result of this is kind of, for omega, is quite obvious. You just there's not much to prove. It's just d pi d phi, because thanks to this identification, we just replace into omega sigma little phi and pi for phi and phi dot, and that's what omega is. For the scalar field, omega is d pi d phi. So when we pull it back, we just replace pi with phi dot and phi with curly phi, and we should get omega sigma, and indeed is what we find. So in that way, it's a simple check. So P, if you want, is the map that sends phi to the pair phi at sigma. So maybe I should write it like this. Phi and pi is by definition the projection of phi, which I have constructed to be phi phi dot. And so it's clear that P omega is equal to omega sigma. Doing the pullback just means replacing this by that in the formula, and so. Good. So pi omega is the canonical, is the expected, in fact, canonical phase space. Canonical phase space. We used no equations of motion. Why I'm emphasizing this? Because this is different from what we did a few lectures ago, a couple of weeks ago, which was to say, oh, there we had to go on shell. And by going on shell and restricting to a surface, we were noticing that these phi and phi dot were the initial, they were in one-to-one correspondence with each solution of the equations of motion. And therefore, these were good coordinates for to think about this abstract space of on-shell histories. Whereas here, we never went on-shell. So what made in the previous story the symplectic structure non-degenerate was going on shell, was this restriction to the shell, which we could, Whereas here, we are doing it differently. We are taking this quotient. For the scalar field, there's a bit of a coincidence that the two procedures match. Remark, in this case, F with omega sigma pulled back to the space of solution is isomorphic to the canonical phase space. And again, the weird thing is that here I'm using the equations of motion, and here I'm not. So there are two different procedures. They don't have to match a priori. In fact, in a gauge theory, they will not give the same result. Questions? Before I do electromagnetism, which by now you know by heart because you spent a few hours on it. Example. Maxwell. Okay, so Maxwell, we have our Lagrangian.
I wonder what is the best.
Let me do it in in tensor variables. So we have FAB, and our field space is the space of one forms over M. And this is the electromagnetic gauge potential. Theta will be delta A F A B. Well, probably with a minus, so FB, whatever, up to, again, my signs need not be the most accurate. So theta is DA F and epsilon. So you might have written this as delta A wedge star F. The fact that there is a star here translates to the fact that these are not wedged, but contracted. Okay, so this is theta, and so our omega sigma is the integral over sigma of, well, we need to vary another time, so we vary this guy, and we get, well, I don't like this minus, so I think I want to get... Let me get rid of it. Can I get rid of it? Maybe by putting a minus there. Maybe that's the right thing to do. Okay, so this becomes delta FAB delta A epsilon B. Do you remember, Sasha?
I hope
you know. Okay. In any case, maybe Okay, the signs are not too important in any case. They don't change the kernels and anything like that. So this is omega, but this has to be thought as an f of A. It's a functional of A. It's not its own independent field, of course. Okay, so now we need to look at the kernel of this. And so the heuristic way is to say, okay, what is, well, we need to, let me write it even more explicitly. So as before, this epsilon B is n times the intrinsic volume. So this will be nB delta FAB wedge delta A epsilon zero. So this is just the volume over sigma. And so we see that here we're getting the, morally, this is like the zero component of F, right? So this becomes, let's do it for if sigma is equal to the t equals zero slice of Minkowski. Here we get that omega sigma is df0i wedge delta I. Right? So an f0i is, again, up to signs, d0ai minus the IA0, probably. Okay, so this is our phi dot, is analogous to phi dot. And here there is this A0 that appears, but there is no A0 over there. So A0, remark. Is by working a bit harder, one could find the same structure over a general Cauchy slice. I will not do it, it's just more work, but there's no, so I will work with the t equals zero slice, which is easier. But we're not losing much conceptually. So this remark, A0 appears only in F0i. So this is a bit of an odd situation, because before, for every phi, there was a phi dot, but there is no A0 dot anywhere. In fact, there is no A0 dot in the Lagrangian, because the Lagrangian depends on F, and there is no F0, 0 component. Like, you would need the 0, 0 component, but that cancels. So that's why there is no A0 dot. So now this is, so heuristically, if we look at the kernel, so the kernel is everything, every x that leaves f0i and ai unchanged, right? Well, it's not this is the same calculation as before would now lead to this result. The only thing is that one should do this a bit more carefully to take care of a knot properly, but the result is pretty much the same. And therefore, F modulo the kernel, which is our P, will be given by the set of AI and EI defined as the value of AI at sigma and the value of F0i at sigma. So the analogy is the straight phi pi curly phi dot curly phi. Just like up there. And this is some equivalence class of all the A's, which carry the same value of those. Okay, does that? So in this case, again, it's kind of trivial now to read out the symplectic structure on P. It's just delta E delta A. Good. So, remark, summarizing, the space, this phase space is the space, well, there's not,
well, maybe I don't summarize it because it's all here. It's
just, now, the point, the question is, does this, as before, coincide with the space of von Schell. So do we still have this isomorphism? Is this canonical phase space related to our covariant phase space in any way? Question? Is F omega sigma isomorphic to P omega for Maxwell? What is the answer? Of course, if I ask it like this, the answer is no. What are we missing? So can someone tell me what's
going wrong in this? Well, why not? Can you see what's the reason why this cannot be the case? So this was an off-shell construction. We never used the equations of motion. We did use the equation of motion. Well, by definition, this is built out of the equation of motion. So do you see an equation of motion that has some consequence for the electric fields and magnetic potentials on sigma? Is there of the Maxwell equations, there are four of them. Two contain time derivatives. Two don't. One says that B is divergence free, and here we don't have to worry about it because we're working with the gauge potential. The other one says that E is divergence free. This E is completely free. The shell contains, requires So there is one, now I will comment why this is a consequence of gauge, but
what we see is that differently from the scalar field, in this case, in this of Maxwell theory, there is there is an extra equation of motion that is not really about evolution. It's a constraint on the initial data. So we call it a constraint. So in fact, it's called the Gauss constraint. Let's give it a name. Gauss constraint. And when one talks about constraint, one means that it is a constraint on the initial data for the theory. Okay, so where does it come from? The claim is that the Gauss constraint is a consequence of gauge symmetry. Okay, so how do we see that this constraint is related to gauge? Which theorems did we prove that about a theory with the gauge symmetry?
Noether 2.
Noether 2. So Noether 2 was saying, so okay, let's, there are a couple of ways. So let's start from Noether 2, which is great. Noether 2 was saying, now we will get it, no, let's see, dai alpha dagger ei equals 0, which was not equations of motions are not all independent. Which meant that we had to identify different configurations. So to get a deterministic system, we need to identify configurations related by the local symmetry. So here we have not identified anything, so we cannot have a deterministic system. So to have a symplectic structure that is non-degenerate and also that speaks well to the shell, we need to mod out by the gauge, and we haven't done it yet. But we have not mod out gauge yet. Here, I mean in P. Okay, so this is a first way to see the problem indeed. We had a related theorem. There was Noether 2 part 2 in a way. I don't know, I don't think I gave it a name. What was the second consequence of gauge symmetries? So Noether 1 was saying that dj of xi is equal to some equations of motion, some combination of the equations of motion. And we said that the gauge symmetry has consequences for both sides, for E, and this is the one, and for j. Do you remember what was the consequence for j?
Vanishing charges?
Yes, exactly. So charges, so another way of saying it is that J, so we had this on shell, the charge vanish, and this is because J psi is plus some exact stuff. and this vanishes on shell. Like the bulk piece of the neutral current vanishes on shell. So that once I integrate it, I get zero. These two are, of course, free. So here, this is the point. So what was J for E and M, for Maxwell? Do you remember calculating J in tutorial? This was dA xi. Well, here we need an index. Let's put B, FAB. Well, let's do it like this. And so if I integrate this on sigma, so what is, maybe I should have said, what is Q sigma, in fact? This was probably a better. Q sigma is, since sigma has no boundary, is the integral of dA xi f, sorry, di d0i. But this is nothing else than precisely xi the divergence of E. So exactly, the second consequence is the vanishing of the charges. And this is something about what is happening on a fixed surface again. And so this is what we're missing. We're precisely missing the Gauss constraint. So okay, now how are these two related to each other? It's not that we have point one and point two unrelated, but point one and point two talk to each other. What is the equation that relates gauge symmetry to J or to Q? We wrote it many times.
Sorry, can you repeat? What is the gauge symmetry?
We need an equation that relates gauge symmetry over field space to Q. So if we have a phase space and a symmetry, what we really want to compute is the Hamiltonian flow, which for Young-Mills had no extra term, so it looked nice for Maxwell. And integrating over sigma, we get this minus delta Q sigma of xi. So we see that Q, so the Gauss constraint, is the generator of our charges. So if we go to so this is in F, and if I go to P, in P I find I rho xi omega. Going to P is just taking care of the kernel of this, is minus integral of xi dii. And rho, how does rho act on little a, I, and ae? Well, it changes I by the derivative of xi and does nothing to e because it was the electromagnetic, it was f. F is gauge invariant. So if I plug this in omega, which I wrote down there, this is what you get after an integration by parts. Yes.
So does that mean every time I have a gauge symmetry, I'm going to have some discrepancy between the canonical and the covariant phase space?
You want, sorry?
I'm going to have a discrepancy between the canonical and the covariant phase space.
Yes. So I will. This is where I want to go next time. Mm-hmm. So here we see that if we impose the equations of motion also on the surface, which we need to do eventually, we are not done yet. So how do we do the next step? In fact, it's like is similar to the one we did before. We impose this, and then we have to mod out by the kernel, but the kernel is precisely the gauge transformation now. So this extra step is the exactly point one in the canon in the usual way. And at that point, I have again a symplectic phase space which knows about the shell. So it's the true physical phase space at the end of the day. So the reason why this canonical one is also important is because usually it's easier to quantize, so you can, because it's just dp dq. So it's the starting point in most textbooks about quantization of, unless you're doing a covariant quantization, but let's say the most conservative old school way of doing quantization is to promote this bracket of E and I, E and A to a commutator, right? And then you start worrying about how to impose the Gauss constraint and so on. So the canonical quantization, not the covariant one, the canonical quantization starts from here. And if you read Weinberg, there is a chapter about it and so on. So, and then we will see. But it's not the end of the story. One has to impose the constraint. So, and this is what we do classically here next time. And then we will do the same thing for gravity, and we will see what changes and what stays the same.
So the statement is, to find the canonical, if I just mod out by what we said initially from my original phase space, from my covariant phase space, from the original phase space, then I conclude that somehow the canonical one doesn't exist. I have to impose further constraints to get to something that makes.
Yeah. So in this case, we didn't use the shell. So here we did, in the scalar field case, it didn't matter if we used the shell or not, there was this coincidence. Here, it cannot be the case because there are some equations of motion which are not about time evolution, are about constraining the initial data on the surface, and these are called constraints, in this case, the Gauss constraint. And so in the canonical phase space, it contains more things than physically allowed. Removing them means, again, losing a. If I remove those modes, the if I fix the Gauss constraint, I have more A's than E's. So if I want to get rid of the extra A's, those extra A's are precisely the gauge mode of A. So you could start from. You don't have to postulate that your A has a gauge symmetry. It's kind of the theory is telling you that is what is happening. If you look at all the equations of motion, everything, and you want to go down to a phase space where that is symplectic and has no redundancies and so on, then you have to identify the A's that are related by gauge transformation. So you can see it here. If this is imposed, rho is in the kernel, so the gauge symmetry is in the kernel. So I need to take care of it and quotient it up.
Aldo?
Yeah.
You said that phase space that we found first in P and omega, it's easier to quantize. Can you? Is it the same? Like you first quantize that phase space and then. After you impose the constraint?
Yes. So this is a big topic in mathematics too, understanding when the two procedures commute. Is goes under the slogan quantization commutes with reduction. So of course in field theory it's a difficult matter because everything is infinite dimensional and so on. But in finite dimensional situations where one can do geometric quantization rigorously and so on, proving theorems about quantization commutes with reduction is a bit of a business, and you can find very interesting formulas out of this idea. So it's a bit of a leitmotif. It's not a theorem. You might have to find the right quantization procedure that will commute with the reduction. But the reduction is a classical procedure, is always the same, well-defined. Quantization is the tricky part. And especially quantizing reduced fields is hard because they have a complicated geometric structure usually. They are usually singular even. Whereas these canonical phase spaces are always cotangent bundles, so they're easy. Because when you mod out something, you don't know what comes out of it. Whereas here you're just doing P delta Q, and so it's always a cotangent bundle of